Okay, well, thank you so much, Yongbek, for the kind introduction. It's always dangerous, I guess, to be introduced as a good speaker, so I hope to not let people down. All right, so today I want to tell a story about the pursuit of what are known as Majorana modes and condensed matter systems. This is an area that's generated quite a lot of excitement in the community over the past several years, both from theorists and experimentalists. The reason is that, as I will try to argue, Majorana modes offer us really exciting opportunities for discovering new basic fundamental physics. And furthermore, we hope to eventually use those interesting fundamental physics properties to solve what's arguably the greatest technological challenge in physics, namely building scalable quantum computing hardware. So as the talk goes on, I'd like to give you a sense for what kind of interesting discoveries await as we journey up this metaphorical Majorana mountain towards eventual quantum computing applications. Before I go any further, I just wanted to pause to acknowledge many people I've had a lot of fun working with over the last 7 years or so on this problem, as well as funding from various agencies. Certainly all these people taught me pretty much everything I know about this problem, and nothing I say would be possible without their guiding me along. Okay, so here's a quick outline for what I hope to cover in the talk. My entire talk is going to center around what are known as non-abelian anions, so I'm going to kick things off by telling you what those are and why they're interesting. That will lead me to a discussion of the pursuit of Majorana modes in solid-state systems. After that, I'm going to try to give you some flavor for where we hope to be heading in the next couple of years in this problem, and then I'll end with some brief closing remarks. Okay, so to introduce non-abelian anions, I want to back up and just quickly review the notion of exchange statistics. As we learn in undergraduate quantum mechanics, exchange statistics describes how wave functions transform when you take indistinguishable particles and exchange their positions. For example, let's suppose you have some three-dimensional material supporting various identical particles indicated by those green circles, and let's define the wave function that tells us the probability for finding the particles in this particular configuration by psi. Suppose now that we take two of these particles, let's say this one and this one, and then move them around until they swap positions. If you were to track how that wave function evolves during the course of that exchange, what you'll find is that after you completed the interchange of those particles, your original wave function psi becomes some wave function psi prime, and the relation between psi and psi prime defines the exchange statistics for those particles. I should emphasize that this property is extraordinarily fundamental. Exchange statistics is really one of the basic cornerstones of many particle quantum mechanics. Right? And in fact, if you think about it, many, if not most, condensed matter phenomena that we see in nature have their origins in terms of exchange statistics from, let's say, the existence of metals, insulators, superfluids, superconductors, and so on. Now, in terms of exchange statistics, nature allows for only a few different classes of particles. Two that we're all familiar with are ordinary bosons and fermions, for which the wave function under a single exchange either stays the same in the case of bosons or gets an extra minus sign in the case of fermions. For deep mathematical reasons, it turns out that all elementary particles that exist in our universe must be one or the other, either bosons or fermions, and there's no room for anything else at the level of fundamental particles. But interestingly, this does not quite exhaust the full set of possibilities that nature allows us to find. In what I think is one of the most remarkable manifestations of the Moore's difference idea. If you take large collections of bosons and fermions, allow them to interact, those composite systems can, in some sense, give birth to new kinds of emergent particles known as anions, which have more interesting statistics than the microscopic constituents. So anions can be further subdivided into two categories. The first are so-called abelian anions. If you exchange two abelian anions, what happens is that the wave function acquires a complex phase factor e to the I theta that's intermediate between plus or minus 1. We call these abelian anions because sequential exchanges commute. If you want to perform multiple exchanges, the wave function just acquires the sum of the phase factors for each individual exchange, independent of of the order in which they're carried out. This is already quite exotic physics, although it turns out that we know of many experimental realizations of abelian anions. In fact, it's almost certainly the case that any fractional quantum Hall phase that's routinely observed in laboratories across the world almost certainly support abelian anions, even if direct confirmation of that fact is non-trivial. My talk today is going to center around the second category of anions, so-called non-abelian anions, which are much more exotic and elusive objects compared to their abelian cousins. Okay, so to illustrate what a non-abelian anion is, let's suppose that you happen to have some exotic phase of matter that supports these kinds of emergent excitations. For simplicity, I'm going to assume that the ground state of the system, before you excite any anions into your system, just has a unique ground state, and that there's a gap to all excitations in the system. Okay, so starting from there, as we start to nucleate non-abelian anions into our system, something really quite interesting happens. When we pull out the first pair of anions, we'll find that there's not just a single ground state available, but two ground states. If we pull out a second pair, we'll find that now there are four ground states available. Pulling out a third pair will generate eight, and so on. Okay, so the moral is that as you start, the more of these non-abelian anions you introduce into your system, you get an exponentially growing number of ground states that are available. This is a pretty weird property, but at this point you may be a bit unimpressed. You might counter with the observation that you can get actually very similar looking physics and in a very conventional setting. Just take an insulator with a bunch of free spin a halves, right? So when I say free spin a halves, I just mean isolated spin a half moments that can be spin up or spin down with equal energy cost. Okay. So in this case, you will once again get a ground state degeneracy similar to what you had up here. And in fact, every additional free spin a half that you introduce will lead to an extra factor of two in the ground state degeneracy, and you'll similarly get an exponentially large number of low energy states. Right? So that's true. But I want to emphasize the qualitative difference between the kinds of ground state degeneracies one finds here and up here in the non-abelian anion case. So first of all, in the case of these free spin a halves, I can, at least in principle, perform local measurements, basically just reading off the value of the individual spins in my system to ascertain which of these various different ground states my system's actually realizing. On the contrary, in the case of these non-abelian anions, even as a matter of principle, there's no possible local measurement that I can perform in the vicinity of these anions or anywhere else for that matter to tell me where in this ground state manifold my system's actually living. Right? And in a closely related property, the degeneracy that we find down here is actually not very robust. I can easily lift this degeneracy by applying local perturbations. For example, if you introduce a local Zeeman field, that'll favor spin up over spin down, and rather easily split this degeneracy or remove it entirely. In sharp contrast, for these non-abelian anions, such local perturbations are completely benign and cannot actually split these ground states. Okay, so there's two important lessons that we learn from this comparison. One, this ground state degeneracy is not ordinary. These ground states are all locally indistinguishable from each other. And second, these anions must somehow carry unusual zero energy modes to somehow encode this exponentially growing number of locally indistinguishable ground states. So that's the first important property of non-abelian anions. Let's now go a little bit further. Suppose that you initialize your system into one of those locally indistinguishable ground states, which I'll call psi sub I. If you now braid two of these non-abelian anions around each other, perform an exchange, then something really quite interesting happens. This wave function that we began with is not just going to acquire plus or minus one, or for that matter, will it in general acquire a complex phase factor, but instead the act of exchanging these non-abelian anions fundamentally transforms your system's quantum state. Okay. So after this exchange, we'll find that we went from our initial state psi sub I to a physically different member of this locally indistinguishable ground state manifold. Okay, so more formally, this exchange is characterized not by a phase, but by a matrix, a braid matrix Uij, which quantifies precisely how that exchange rotated our quantum state inside of that subspace. Now, we know that matrix multiplication is generally non-commutative, and what this implies for a system of non-abelian anions is that if you perform multiple exchanges, order not matters. In other words, if you want to perform the final state that you end up in after some sequence of exchanges is very sensitive to the sequence in which those individual exchanges were carried out. This is why we call this phenomenon non-abelian statistics. This is quite amazing, and in fact, this is the most exotic form of exchange statistics that nature allows us to find, even as a matter of principle. So this is the second key feature of non-abelian anions. The third one I want to emphasize is that they always exhibit what I'll call non-trivial fusion rules. To put this property into perspective, you might consider, let's say, taking an electron and a positron. Right? It's if I bring an electron and positron together, there's no question what's going to happen. They're antiparticles, and they're going to annihilate each other. Okay. In the case of non-abelian anions, there's never a unique answer to what happens when you bring two of them together. They might annihilate, or they might, for example, form a completely different kind of particle altogether. Okay, so this is these, if you want, are the three basic pillars of non-abelian anions: locally indistinguishable ground states, non-abelian statistics, and non-trivial fusion rules. I think this is really quite amazing physics in its own right. The story gets even more interesting when one realizes that there are practical applications to all of this, as pointed out by Alexei Kitaev in one of his many brilliant works. Alexei made the important observation that if you had a system of non-abelian anions, you could use that system to, in principle, build a so-called topological quantum computer that's immune at the level of the system's hardware to the usual kinds of noise, local noise processes that tend to plague conventional approaches to building quantum computers. Let me sketch a basic idea of how this works. We can embed quantum bits or qubits in the space of locally indistinguishable ground states. That's a really nice place to store quantum information. Basically, the quantum information is embedded in some global properties of the wave function. That's what the local indistinguishability guarantees us. And so the same property that makes it, let's say, difficult for me as an experimenter, if I were an experimenter, to, let's say, read out the state of my qubits, also makes it difficult for local perturbations from the environment to mess up that information. Furthermore, we can exploit braiding operations and non-abelian statistics to process those qubits, right, to controllably rotate them. And from this point of view, you can view these braid matrices U as representing quantum gates that are acting on your set of qubits. And finally, we can exploit non-trivial fusion rules, basically bring these guys together, intentionally spoil degeneracies to allow ourselves to read out the answer at the end of some quantum computation. I've labeled this Alexei's $3 million idea. Maybe some of you know why I did that. For this work, he's actually received many prizes, including this year's Buckley Prize. And some years ago, he was one of the inaugural winners of the Fundamental Physics Prize, which carried, indeed, a $3 million cash award. Incidentally, this is not split, unlike the Nobel Prize. Right? He just gets $3 million, period. So Alexei already answered, if you want, the $3 million question for us. He taught us how we can, in principle, make an inherently fault-tolerant topological quantum computer. But the billion-dollar question in this field remains unanswered, which is how do you actually build the hardware that goes into bringing this beautiful idea to experimental life? Over the last, 10 years or so, there's been what I would argue is a revolution in how we begin to answer this question. And I thought it'd be fun to put this in perspective in terms of what I'm calling the Fisher plot. When I was in graduate school, my advisor, Matthew Fisher, once described problems in theoretical physics to me according to, in terms of this two-dimensional space with experimental relevance on one axis and theoretical novelty on another. So in general, where one prefers to work in this two-dimensional space is largely a matter of taste. Perhaps the one universally agreed upon thing is that, we shouldn't be spending too much time near the origin, right? No one wants to be working on problems that are neither interesting nor experimentally relevant. But outside of that, I think there is certainly value to working anywhere else in that space. Matthew also taught me that it's ideal in some sense to work as far out in this direction as you can. I think there's a sweet spot here in the sense that if you're working on problems out here, this is where you can actually have a meaningful dialogue with experimentalists, pitch some idea, and if you're lucky, they might even try following that up in their laboratories. So non-abelian anions were invented by mathematical physicists in the late 1980s. And in those days, this problem would certainly have belonged very far along this theoretical novelty axis, but in those early days had no obvious experimental home. That began to change in 1991. In 1991, there was a major push in the vertical direction, and that ascent towards experimental relevance has been particularly rapid, particularly over the last 6 or 7 years, in the context of the pursuit of so-called Majorana-Fermion zero modes. Right? So Majorana-Fermion zero modes are the simplest source of all the interesting non-abelian anion properties that I described to you on the previous slide. Before I say what those are, I wanted to just say a few brief words about the person who they're named after. So they're named after this fellow, Ettore Majorana. He's actually a quite interesting and enigmatic historical figure in science. And to illustrate why, I wanted to share with you a couple of quotes from Enrico Fermi, who worked quite closely with Ettore Majorana many years ago. Here's the first quote. So it's kind of long, so let me just paraphrase. Fermi says that there are, you know, many categories of scientists. There are okay scientists, really good scientists. And then there are geniuses like Galileo and Newton. And Fermi says, well, Ettore Majorana was one of those caliber geniuses. That's a pretty strong statement, and it's a particularly sad statement in light of the dates that are listed down here. So Ettore Majorana was not around for all that long. He was born in 1906 and is believed to have died in 1938, although there's a question mark here. We don't really know exactly what happened to him. All that we do know for sure is that in 1938 he was supposed to take a boat trip, I think, to or from Naples, and nobody ever saw him after that. I'll share with you a second quote from Fermi, which may or may not be relevant to his disappearance. Fermi also said, Majorana had greater gifts than anyone else in the world. Unfortunately, he lacked one quality which other men generally have, plain common sense. So there's at least one interpretation of you know, one theory for what might have happened to Ettore Majorana that's consistent with this. You know, one theory postulates that he may have abandoned the glorious life of a physicist and went off into seclusion in a Spanish monastery somewhere. Okay, so that's, I don't know if that's true. You know, there are more tragic possible explanations for what happened to him, including suicide as a result of ongoing health problems. So we may never quite know exactly what happened to Ettore Majorana in 1938, but one thing that we do know for sure is that shortly before his disappearance, he made a very important discovery in physics that remains actually quite relevant even in the modern era. Okay, in particular, shortly before he disappeared, Ettore Majorana realized that apart from the ordinary kinds of fermions that were known about in his day, like electrons and positrons, it was in principle possible to construct a new kind of fermion that was its own antiparticle. That's what a Majorana fermion is to a high-energy physicist. It's a kind of fermionic particle that is its own antiparticle. Ettore Majorana originally suggested that neutrinos might realize this new kind of fermion, and quite amazingly, so many decades later, this remains a serious proposition. And in fact, there are ongoing experiments searching for a process known as neutrinoless double beta decay that can only occur if neutrinos are Majorana fermions. Okay. Another place that high-energy physicists invoke Majorana fermions is in dark matter theories. So there are supersymmetric theories that have been postulated that suggest that Majorana fermions might be one source of dark matter in our universe. Condensed matter physicists like myself are mainly interested in Majorana fermions of a very different variety compared to those that appear in high-energy contexts. We are mainly interested in pursuing Majorana fermion zero modes. So first of all, my working definition of a Majorana fermion as a condensed matter physicist will be that these are some kind of excitations described by fermionic operators gamma that are their own Hermitian conjugate. That's the Majorana fermion aspect. The zero mode aspect comes from, I'll call this a Majorana fermion zero mode if acting with that operator doesn't change the system's energy. Or alternatively, if that operator commutes with a Hamiltonian and therefore has no energy cost associated with it. So this relation, gamma equals gamma dagger, kind of evokes the idea of a particle being its own antiparticle, although I caution that these are not quite particles for reasons that I will elaborate on shortly. I should also stress that it's these Majorana fermion zero modes that give rise to interesting non-abelian anion physics and eventual quantum computing applications. In contrast, you know, if we happen to discover tomorrow that, let's say, neutrinos are Majorana fermions, that would be a phenomenally interesting discovery, but would have no bearing on quantum computing applications. Okay. So these high-energy physics Majorana fermions are really fermions, even in the exchange statistics sense. So for this reason, since these are rather different from what Ettore Majorana envisioned so long ago, he's less, I would say, the hero of the story compared to people like Nick Reed, Volovic, and Katayev, all of whom, for some reason, I decided to indicate are still alive, I guess, to parallel that up there. Okay, so with that introduction, let me now switch gears and begin focusing on the quest for these Majorana fermion zero modes in solid-state systems. Okay, so it might sound a little bit weird, the suggestion of finding anything that looks remotely like a Majorana fermion in any piece of condensed matter, basically because we know that all materials that ultimately are composed out of ordinary electrons and ions, none of which are Majorana fermions. So let me elaborate briefly on this point by describing the kinds of electronic excitations we can make in a typical garden variety metal or insulator. One thing I can always do is I can add an excited electron above the system's Fermi energy. Operationally, I can do this by acting with an electron creation operator C dagger on the ground state psi. That adds a negatively charged electron to the system. Alternatively, I can take away an electron or equivalently add a positively charged hole. And this I can do formally by acting with a hole creation operator C on the ground state psi. So these electrons and holes are antiparticles of one another. They can annihilate back into the vacuum. But they're definitely not Majorana fermions because they carry an opposite electric charge. Right? So at the level of these operators, we know that C dagger is not equal to C and therefore does not satisfy the Majorana fermion property I defined earlier. So this is a rather general problem, and what it suggests, I think, is that if we're going to find something like a Majorana fermion excitation in solid state systems, it must be in the form of a non-trivial emergent excitation arising from non-trivial dynamics of, you know, many electrons and ions interacting in some sample. And we know that, you know, interesting things can happen when in the presence of such interactions. Okay, so superconductors are in fact natural platforms for Majorana-like excitations. What happens in a superconductor is that pairs of electrons combine to form what are known as Cooper pairs. Cooper pairs are morally like, just like bosons. They can condense exactly like in a superfluid. And when that Cooper pair condensation takes place, the system spontaneously breaks charge conservation symmetry. So in a superconductor, charge is conserved only mod 2e, twice the electron charge. And that physically reflects the fact that that Cooper pair condensate that arises here can easily absorb any additional Cooper pairs that you throw into the system. Now, because a superconductor spontaneously breaks charge conservation symmetry, excitations naturally correspond to superpositions of electrons and holes. So somewhat schematically, excitations in a superconductor are created by operators F dagger, which are of the form U C dagger plus V times C. By staring at this expression, what you can see is that if for some reason U happens to equal V, then F will be its own Hermitian conjugate and therefore will be a Majorana fermion. It's not as easy as it sounds, however. In order to get Majorana fermion excitations from a superconductor, you need a special kind of phase known as the topological superconductor. I'm going to focus on the simplest example, by far simplest example of such a phase, which is a spinless one-dimensional superconductor. So let's suppose that you take electrons, confine them to one dimension, artificially strip away their spin degree of freedom, and then impose superconductivity. If you do that, then you will get a very interesting topological phase of matter that harbors Majorana fermion zero modes at the left and right ends of the system. Okay. So because of those Majorana fermion zero modes that arise, that are bound to the endpoints of that one-dimensional spinless superconductor, the endpoints of the system behave, for all practical purposes, like non-abelian anions that I described earlier. So what I'd like to do now is flesh out how that non-abelian structure appears in the specific context of this phase. So hopefully this will give you some intuition for how these peculiar properties I mentioned earlier can actually arise in a physical system. So first let me say a little bit more about what a Majorana fermion zero mode is. I mentioned that they are not quite particles. I think instead it's much more useful to think about these Majorana fermion zero modes as half of what you ordinarily think of as a fermion. So to be more precise, in this example where I have two Majorana zero modes, gamma 1 and gamma 2, I can superimpose them, take a gamma 1 plus I gamma 2, and that sum defines a single ordinary fermion operator F. Okay. So I call that an ordinary fermion operator in the sense that it can accommodate, that level can accommodate 0 or 1 particles, just like any, you know, any other electronic state. This fermion, however, is definitely an unusual object in two important respects. First of all, it's highly non-local because it involves a superposition of two Majorana modes that can be separated by arbitrary distances from one another. And second, because gamma 1 and gamma 2 are both zero modes, they don't change the system's energy, that means that I can add or remove a fermion from that F level without, again, changing the system's energy. And hence we have a ground state degeneracy. In this particular context, that ground state degeneracy has a very simple physical interpretation. It consists of one state that has a total even number of electrons in the superconductor and another state where that number is odd. So this is a really unusual situation to find for superconductors. In a conventional superconductor, you'd like to have an even number of electrons in the ground state so that all electrons can simultaneously participate in Cooper pairing. What the Majorana fermion zero modes in this case are telling us is that the energetic distinction between even and odd fermion parity states ceases to exist. So the local indistinguishability arises from the fact that fermion parity is not a local property of the system. Right? There's no way that I can tell whether there's an even or odd number of electrons in this wire by doing a measurement here or doing a measurement here or anywhere else for that matter. Okay? The only way to tell is to do some kind of non-local measurement that knows about the total fermion parity of the entire system. Okay? So that's how local indistinguishability arises in this context. Now we can, if we want, we can dress up the setup a little bit further and add more of these Majorana fermion zero modes. One way I can do this is to, let's say, add in the middle here some, let's say, ordinary insulating part of this one-dimensional system. Basically, that's more the equivalent to just having two one-dimensional spinless superconductors, one here, one here. Each will have its own pair of Majorana fermion zero modes opposite the ends of the system. And since now I have four Majorana zero modes, I now have more ground state degeneracy. I can go further. I can, let's say, add another one-dimensional spinless superconductor in the middle, giving me now six of these zero modes and hence a larger ground state degeneracy still. And you can keep going, and you'll see that this ground state degeneracy grows exponentially, as I mentioned earlier. We can also think about fusion from this point of view. So let's imagine that I bring gamma 5 and gamma 6 together. Right? Eventually, if I destroy this entirely, I'll have fewer Majorana zero modes and hence I'll have less ground state degeneracy. So what must happen here is that as these guys come together, this ground state degeneracy here eventually splits. Right? So this is the process of fusion. If your system happens to end up in the lower part of this these split states, then we can say that those anions that I brought together basically annihilated each other and returned my system to the ground state. Alternatively, you might end up in here in this excited state. And then we would say that those anions fuse to give us an extra finite energy excitation in the system. Okay. So this is how non-trivial fusion rules can arise from these Majorana fermion zero modes. And finally, for braiding statistics, we have to use our imagination a little bit here. But if you imagine somehow figuring out a way to, let's say, braid gamma 3 and gamma 4 around each other, then what that will do is shuttle you from one of these ground states to a physically distinct ground state. And that's the essence of non-abelian braiding statistics. That sounds like a kind of weird property, but from what I've told you so far, it's actually not so counterintuitive. Basically, what we've done here is we've exchanged half of one fermion with half of another fermion, and that's naturally going to do something pretty non-trivial to your ground states. And that's really the essence of non-abelian statistics in this particular context. Okay, so this is, in a nutshell, how Majorana fermion zero modes give rise to non-abelian anion properties. This, I think, is really the simplest target phase to shoot for if you want to find realizations of these ideas. At this point, there's both good news and bad news to this story. The good news is that superconductivity is a very old subject. You know, we now know of thousands of different compounds that are superconducting. The bad news is that we can just go through that list of thousands of known superconductors and ask which of them realize the kind of phase that we're after here. And the answer, unfortunately, is almost certainly zero. Okay. So let me highlight the basic challenges that are involved in trying to find realizations of spinless one-dimensional superconductivity. So the first is sort of obvious. We live in three dimensions. So if we want to find realizations of this kind of phase, we need to confine electrons to artificially reduced dimensional structures. This is can be routinely done, but it does limit the materials options that we have to work with. Second, for better or worse, electrons carry spin. If you look at the energy versus momentum for a typical material, usually you have spin-degenerate bands. And in the ground state, both of those spin states will be partially occupied. And so your system does not look spinless. So if you want to realize this kind of phase, what you need to do is kick out one of those bands so that your system looks effectively like it's spinless. So the third challenge is really the most serious of all, namely, among the many thousands of superconductors that we now know exist, in almost every single case, the superconductivity arises from the formation of spin singlet Cooper pairs. So in other words, in almost every known example, both spin-up and spin-down carriers are absolutely essential to the formation of superconductivity. And that's obviously non-trivial from the point of view of challenge number two. So these are the three basic challenges that we need to solve if we're going to move forward and find realizations of these Majorana-Fermion zero modes. There's two natural paths forward that one can now contemplate in this endeavor. The first would be to look for, in some sense, intrinsic solutions to the problem, basically search for new compounds that happen to realize the exotic superconductivity that we're after. So this may eventually be a viable approach. I don't know, but what I do know is that theorists like myself are not very well equipped to help guide that search, and there's absolutely no modesty here. You know, our inability to contribute along this direction as a community is something that's documented in the literature. In fact, there's a physicist named Bernd Matthias who many years ago came up with a list of guidelines for searching for new and better superconductors. That list is pretty old, and by now, I think most of his guidelines have since been debunked. But one has, I think, stood the test of time, perhaps more than any other, and that's Matthias's sixth rule, which is to stay away from theorists. Okay. So that's not made up, actually. That's really a part of his guidelines. So, you know, even if we had some clever ideas here, we probably would have a hard time convincing experimentalists to follow up on our suggestion. So instead, I'm going to advocate a different kind of approach, which is basically borrowing from the playbook of people that work on cold atoms and try to engineer the kind of topological superconductors that we want by combining available materials that we already understand on their own and that are already widely available on people's shelves all across the world. So theorists can be useful in this engineering approach, especially if the methods that we devise involve weakly interacting electrons, which we tend to be quite good at predicting. So the hope in this engineering approach is that we can conjure up very concrete, quantitative, and hopefully reliable proposals for where topological superconductivity ought to appear. So this engineering strategy has been, I think, a real game changer in the field over the last roughly 10 years. There have been, you know, probably of order 100 or maybe more than that papers written on various different strategies for combining conventional materials in order to generate non-trivial topological phases with Majorana zero modes. I'm not going to go through that list in any detail. I'm instead just going to focus on one particularly influential proposal, which was due to these two groups here, Roman Luchin and company and Yuval Oreg and company, including my colleague Gil Raphael. So these two groups showed us how we can engineer a phase of matter that supports Majorana fermion zero modes using basically semiconducting wires and completely conventional S-wave spin singlet superconductors. So let me try to illustrate how their scheme works by basically building up the physics one step at a time. So a key element in their proposal are one-dimensional semiconducting wires that have strong spin orbit coupling. So you should think about something like, let's say, indium antimonide or indium arsenide. Let me start by thinking about the band structure of that wire in the absence of spin orbit coupling. Without spin orbit coupling, if you look at the energy versus momentum, you just find two spin degenerate parabolas, one for spin up and one for spin down. Let's now turn on spin orbit coupling. Spin orbit coupling will partially lift that spin degeneracy. It'll basically shift the spin up parabola rightwards and the spin down parabola leftwards. If we now stare at that band structure, you can see that it's not quite what we'd like to have, because regardless of where you put your Fermi level here, you'll always be partially occupying both the spin up and spin down branches, and so the system doesn't yet look spinless. The beauty of these one-dimensional wires is that this problem is very easy to fix. We can simply apply a magnetic field to the system. That magnetic field opens up a Zeeman-induced gap at zero momentum. So this is what the band structure looks after introducing that magnetic field. And now we have a nice sweet spot. If your chemical potential happens to sit in that field-induced gap, then we have just a single partially occupied band. And in this important sense, our system now looks like it's effectively spinless. Importantly, however, the carriers at the right side of this partially occupied band are mostly spin up because of spin orbit coupling, and similarly the states on the left side are mostly spin down. Okay. So this is a really important property for superconductivity, which is the last ingredient. Suppose that we now take this spin orbit coupled wire and couple it to a completely conventional garden variety spin singlet superconductor. So once we do that, the electrons in this wire can tunnel into that conventional superconductor and back, and due to such hybridization, the electrons in the wire will inherit the properties of that adjacent superconductor. In particular, what's most interesting here is that those electrons will inherit the spin singlet superconductivity that's native to that nearby superconductor. That's something called the proximity effect. So the crucial thing to observe here is that that spin singlet Cooper pair formation can happen very efficiently at the Fermi level, since we have both spin up and spin down states available to form those spin singlets. So as long as your chemical potential is situated in this regime, then your wire will then be driven into a one-dimensional topological superconductor that harbors Majorana or fermion zero modes at the two ends of the wire. Right? So now we're in business. So this was a very important, these are two very important theoretical works, basically because these ingredients and even combinations of these ingredients had been already explored by experimental groups even at the time when these were published. And so this rapidly mobilized a vast experimental effort. Within a couple of years, experimental papers began pouring in with titles that you can see here, Signatures of Majorana Fermions and Superconductor Semiconductor Devices, Evidence of Majorana Fermions, blah, 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 Observation of Majorana Fermions. There's all sorts of, this is a very partial list of papers that have appeared in the years since. All of these, most of these are in fact by different groups, so this is not just one group that's performing all the measurements, but many in various different laboratories. The first real breakthrough experimental paper, I think, was this one by Leo Kruenhoven's group. This appeared in 2012. This initially received lots of fanfare. It was received lots of press coverage. It was ranked as one of Science Magazine's runners-up for Breakthrough of the Year in 2012. A little bit after this paper appeared, Thiers started to re-examine the evidence, and various other alternative proposals were put forward for the interpretation of those measurements that were not related to Majorana fermion zero modes. And so I think the community, including myself, were quite cautious about these results for some time. It's been a long time now since those papers originally appeared, almost 5 years. And in that time, a lot has happened. These groups have gotten exceedingly good at actually making the devices. The quality of the devices and the quality of the measurements have dramatically improved. And as that's happened, the evidence in favor of Majorana fermions has gotten much, much better rather than worse. And I think at this stage, at least I feel pretty confident declaring that the evidence is quite strong in favor of an actual observation of Majorana fermion zero modes in these kinds of devices. Let me now revisit this Majorana mountain. I think this is more or less where we currently stand in this field. There's been very exciting and very impressive progress on the material science front. People have fabricated these devices that one needs to get Majorana fermion zero modes with increasing precision and quality. There's also been increasingly compelling evidence that Majorana fermion zero modes have been detected in these devices. It's worth emphasizing that, just the mere observation of a Majorana fermion zero mode is far from the end of this problem. It's really more the beginning of this problem. And so the question I want to turn to next is, how do we ascend further up this Majorana mountain? For the last part of my talk, I want to describe some results from this many-author paper that appeared last year in PRX. This is a collaboration amongst both theorists and experimentalists. The experimental side was led by Charlie Marcus's group in Copenhagen, and this also involved theory work by both Copenhagen and Caltech researchers. Basically, what this team set out to do is to figure out some hopefully promising strategy for ascending up this Majorana mountain and focusing less on detection of Majorana fermion zero modes and more on how to control them and demonstrate the interesting non-abelian characteristics that they exhibit that eventually allows them to be useful for quantum computing applications. So we came up with that agenda in mind. We tried to do two things. First, we tried to introduce a new method of controlling and reading out the state of Majorana fermion zero modes that borrows from existing technology as much as possible. And second, armed with that technology, we tried to outline some interesting milestone experiments that would reveal important new aspects of non-abelian anion physics. So the first thing I'm going to do is describe the new control and readout scheme that we introduced. Here's the basic device that I'll be showing you for the next several slides, so let me step through each of these components one at a time. This gray region underneath, that's meant to illustrate a spin orbicoupled nanowire like indium arsenide or indium antimonide. This orange region is a mesoscopic superconducting island. So this is a small-scale superconducting shell that's deposited on top of this nanowire. If you want to get a sense for numbers, this might be, let's say, a few tens of nanometers thick and a few microns, for instance, wide. I'm going to introduce a magnetic field, which, according to the proposals I illustrated earlier, is essential for getting Majorana modes in these superconductor, semiconductor devices. This blue region here, that's a schematic for an ordinary macroscopic superconductor. And finally, I'm going to add an all-important ingredient here, which is what I'll call an electrically tunable valve. Physically, that's just a nearby gate electrode that allows me to control how well coupled this superconducting island and this macroscopic superconductor, how well coupled those two subsystems are. When that valve is open, I mean that a charge can readily flow between these two subsystems. In this regime, the fact that it's a mesoscopic superconductor doesn't matter all that much. Basically, everything I told you earlier applies. When we have the magnetic field, as long as the chemical potential is tuned appropriately on this part of the system, then we'll have Majorana fermion zero modes that give us ground state degeneracy between even and odd fermion parity states that are locally indistinguishable from each other. Now, if I close that valve, what I've morally done is completely decoupled this part of the system from this part, sort of like taking scissors and just slicing the system in two here. In this case, we now have over here something that looks like a so-called quantum dot. This is a rather small-scale quantum object that just has a fixed amount of charge swimming on it, a fixed number of electrons. Importantly, this device is sufficiently small that adding even a single extra electron costs a non-trivial amount of charging energy. There's absolutely nothing exotic here. This is really freshman E&M charging physics. It's just, charge squared divided by twice the capacitance. And the capacitance in this case is just sufficiently small that even adding one extra electron to the system costs an appreciable energy. Okay, so here's the important thing. If I started in the even parity state when the valve was open, when I close this valve, I'm going to evolve into the ground state of this quantum dot that just has, let's say, a fixed amount of charge, Q electrons sitting on it. Alternatively, if I started in the odd fermion parity state when the valve was open, closing the valve instead takes me to a different charge state where I have an extra electron swimming in on this island and therefore a higher energy state. Okay, so basically what closing that valve allows me to do is convert these locally indistinguishable states to locally distinguishable quantum dot states, which I can then detect using tools that have been around for ages. Sounds really impressive, right? The ability to distinguish between Q and Q plus one electrons, but the capabilities to do this have been around for ages basically studies of quantum dots. We're going to try to live off of that technology and use it to our advantage in this Majorana problem. Okay, so let me complicate this device a little bit further. Let's now consider a device with two superconducting islands and three of these gate tunable valves. There's lots of freedom, lots of flexibility that this device offers. If all of these valves are closed, then basically I have one quantum dot here and another quantum dot here. I'll call that a double dot. If I open up the middle valve, I can convert that double dot into a single dot, which is just about twice as long. If I open up those outer valves, I can convert this into one long topological superconductor that gives me Majorana fermion zero modes at the two extreme ends. And finally, if I close that middle valve, I can cut that topological superconductor in two, giving me an extra pair of Majorana fermion zero modes opposite that middle valve. So again, we have lots of flexibility, and this flexibility allows me to do, I think, quite interesting experiments, even in this relatively simple one-wire geometry. And as I'll briefly mention later, we get even more possibilities if we adapt these ideas to slightly more complicated geometries. Okay, so that's the control scheme that I'd like to now harness. And the first new kind of experiment that I will illustrate involves probing the non-trivial fusion rules that these non-abelian anions are supposed to exhibit. So this has the advantage, by the way, that it's something that I can probe in far simpler geometries than I can, let's say, than are required to, say, probe non-abelian statistics. So that's why I think this is the first experiment that one should set their sights on beyond Majorana fermion zero mode detection. Okay, so I'm going to show you a very concrete protocol for how to reveal those non-trivial fusion rules. But before I do that, I just want to sketch the basic strategy that's involved. So it's basically a three-step protocol. I'm going to start by using these valves to create, to initialize in a precise way, non-abelian anions that have Majorana fermion zero modes. So that'll give me some locally indistinguishable ground states. Then I'm going to fuse those anions. And physically, I'm going to do this by closing valves to make charging energies large on these islands. And so the idea is that I will convert these even and odd states to these non-degenerate charge states, having charge Q and Q plus 1. If I end up in this ground state Q, I'm going to say that those anions annihilated each other because I've returned to the ground state. I'm going to say here more technically that those anions fuse into the vacuum, which I'll label by I. If instead our system ends up in this excited state with an extra electron on the island, I'll say that those anions fuse non-trivially into a fermion, which I'll call psi. So here, I think this is the only equation I'm ever going to show you in this talk. This is schematically shown. This fusion rule that I've just sketched here is illustrated by this equation, which basically tells us that two of these non-abelian anions can fuse, can basically annihilate each other or produce an extra fermion. So this is basically what I want to try to get experimental evidence for. And finally, I'm just going to use readout tools to detect the presence of these two possible fusion channels. Okay, so I can see that I'm running out of time, so let me be somewhat quick here. I'm going to now show you how you can controllably read out those fusion channels with this two-island device, single-wire two-island device. The name of the game is going to be to tweak these valves in a prescribed way to create anions and then fuse them and then read out the answer. I'm going to do this in two ways. First, I'm going to do it in a not-so-interesting control experiment that doesn't give us exactly what we want, but nevertheless establishes a useful benchmark. And then I'll do this in a more interesting way that actually reveals the information that we want. Okay, so in this control protocol, the first thing I want to do is shut that middle valve. Basically, I then get two of these quantum dots. And let's say we have charge Q left on the left island and charge Q right on the right island. So now I'm going to open up those outer valves and create four non-abelian anions with Majorana zero modes gamma 1 and gamma 2 on the left island and gamma 3 and gamma 4 on the right island. And let's assume that I've converted in this way this Q left, Q right state into a state that has even fermion parity on each of those two islands. The way you should think about this step is that basically what I've done is I've pulled out one pair of anions from the vacuum on the left island and another pair of anions out of the vacuum on the right island. So I've linked by this dashed line which pairs are connected in that fashion. Okay, so there's my anions. Now I want to fuse them, and I'm going to fuse them just by restoring, reclosing those outer valves, converting those parity states into charge states. And as you might imagine, the system's just going to retrace its footsteps, and I'll get back to the state where I have Q left on the left island and Q right on the right island. So if you now use charge sensors to read out those two charge states, what you'll find is that you'll just get a deterministic answer. Okay, so you can repeat this protocol as many times as you want, and with 100% probability, you should every time find exactly the same amount of charge on each of these two islands. So this deterministic readout is not exactly what I want. The reason that there's only one possible outcome here is that I've pulled out two anions from the vacuum, and then I've just refused exactly the same anions that I generated from the vacuum in the first place. And so basically this process, this protocol that I've illustrated here, blocks access to the psi channel. Okay, so once again, that's not what I want, but it's a useful benchmark to keep in mind. So now what I'd like to do is go back to the top here and redo this protocol, just tweaking the order in which I apply these valves in a slightly different way. Okay, so let's start from this single dot configuration once again, and then the first step I'm going to do here is open the outer valves. So now I've converted this whole thing into one long topological superconductor, and here you can think about this process as taking a single pair of anions out of the vacuum and then moving them to opposite sides of the device. So next I'm going to close the middle valve, which pulls out another pair of anions out of the vacuum and just has them sit opposite that middle valve. So if you actually stare at these two configurations, they're exactly the same in terms of the valves, but from these dashed lines you can see that I've parked my system into a physically different state here compared to here. In fact, here these islands are disentangled, whereas here they remain, in fact, maximally entangled, and the state of the system is a superposition of even-even and odd-odd. So now if we fuse these anions by closing the outer valves, we're going to get a non-deterministic answer. The state will end up in a superposition of Q left, Q right. That's the same state we ended up in here, plus another state for these quantum dots that have charge Q left plus 1 and Q right plus 1 on those two islands. So in this case, the readout is probabilistic, in fact, maximally probabilistic, indicating the access to not only the identity channel, but also the psi fusion channel. Okay. So this is, you know, this probabilistic readout is what you really like to find. The reason that I've shown you this control protocol, by the way, is that if I didn't show you the left side, if I just showed you the right, I would be urging you to get excited about a maximally random readout, right? And, you know, maximally random measurement outcomes can arise for completely uninteresting reasons just due to, let's say, random charge fluctuations floating in and out of your system. So that's why this control protocol helps to rule out those boring explanations for the probabilistic readout. Okay, so that's fusion rule detection. There are ongoing experiments that are trying to pursue this at the moment. I can't show you confirmation yet, but hopefully that will be forthcoming. Maybe I'll just very briefly touch upon non-abelian braiding. We can use similar ideas in slightly more complicated geometries to actually invoke exchanges. I won't go through the details here. I'll just sketch the basic idea. So these first two islands are basically what I was invoking before, and now I'm just appending this vertical island as a means to help me to exchange these anions in a meaningful way. Okay, so let's start in a configuration where we have four of these zero modes. And my goal now is to exchange gamma 2 and gamma 3 by doing some prescribed sequence of manipulations of those central valves. Okay, so the first step is I'm going to open up this valve and open up this valve. What that basically does is converts these two islands into one single long topological superconductor and effectively shuttles gamma 2 down here. All right. So next, I'm going to toggle these two valves. I'm going to close this one and open this one. That basically merges these two islands into a single topological superconductor and teleports gamma 3 over to where gamma 2 initially sat. And finally, I'll just reclose these two valves, and that moves gamma 2 up to gamma 3's initial position. So that imparts a completely meaningful and well-defined exchange of these two Majorana-Fermion zero modes and will lead to a probabilistic readout if you then fuse, very similar to what I described for fusion. Okay, so let me not go through that. Let me just close here very briefly. Once again, this is basically where we are in this problem in terms of what we've accomplished. Great progress on the device fabrication and detection front. I think we are currently amidst what I'll call the Majorana characterization era. You know, so far the emphasis has naturally been on just making sure that we actually have devices that support Majorana fermion zero modes. We're now in a position, I think, where it makes a lot of sense to begin thinking about the new era in this problem, which I think is hopefully going to be an era aimed at Majorana control. I've described to you a couple of potentially interesting milestone experiments that can help usher in that era, one involving fusion rule detection, another involving braiding. We also incidentally described a protocol for validating the topological protection of quantum information in these devices, but in the interest of time, I didn't go through that. But the essence here is that these basic milestones really establish, I think, the essence of non-abelian anion physics that's relevant for quantum computation in as minimal device geometries as I think is possible. Okay. So hopefully in a few years I can eventually come and give part 2 of this talk where I describe how all 3 of these things have been done, but we'll have to see how that goes. Okay. So thank you for attention and sorry for the time. Thank you. Yeah, so in fact, let me tell you what happened in 1991. So I mentioned that, you know, 1991 there was this big boost towards experimental relevance, and that was, in fact, in the context of 2D systems. So the very first candidate platform for realizing these non-abelian anions and Majorana-Fermion zero modes was in the context of a two-dimensional fractional quantum Hall state, so the so-called Moore-Reed state. around 10 years after that, people realized that you didn't actually need that strongly correlated phase of matter. You can actually, there's a counterpart to that more Reed state, which is a spinless two-dimensional superconductor. And in that two-dimensional realization, it's superconducting vortices that harbor Majorana zero modes and are the analog of the endpoints of the one-dimensional superconductors that I described. So indeed, these things historically were first realized to occur in two-dimensional systems and then were eventually distilled, I think, into simpler one-dimensional systems. Yeah, sure. So this is a very important question. So basically, you can imagine that there's some nearby gate that applies an electric field to this region of the system. And what that electric field allows you to do is control how many carriers sit in that barrier. Okay. So when the valve is open, what I mean is that there's you have lots of carriers in that barrier, which allow for easy shuttling of charge from one end of the system to another. So more technically, you want to maximize the Josephson coupling between these two superconducting systems. When the valve is closed, what I mean is that I've adjusted that electric field such that I vacate all carriers from that barrier, and that's the limit where basically you can think about these things as just electrically decoupled from each other. Now, full disclosure, in order for this to work, we need to be able to achieve high on-off ratios in the sense that we need to, you know, when the valve is open, have a coupling between these two systems which is much larger than the charging energy that I get when the valve is closed. And that capability has not yet been demonstrated, although people are trying.
Thank you.